From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Men's sports, political influence, and sexual assault. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Last year, a 14-year-old cheerleader claimed she was raped by a football star at a drunken high school party. When the town found out, she got the blame. Her mother lost her job. The family home was burned down. The sheriff says there was evidence for a strong rape case, but the DA refused to prosecute. Investigative reporting has raised disturbing questions, and this week came an announcement. The case will be re-examined. It was one incident in small-town Missouri, but some see a broader pattern of toleration for sexual assault, especially when male athletes are involved. Today's talking point, a terrorist bomb and an effort at understanding. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney back with To the Point. Officials in Missouri announced this week they will re-examine a controversial case of alleged rape. A 14-year-old girl and her family were blamed and bullied, and the local prosecutor dropped felony charges. Is it an isolated incident or a case that's all too familiar? Today's talking point, we'll hear what happened when a Jewish-American writer tried to meet the Palestinian bomber who almost killed his wife. First, this news update. For years, Saudi Arabia has campaigned for a seat on the UN Security Council. Yesterday, for the first time in history, it was finally elected. But in an unprecedented act of protest, it was refused to accept. Colm Lynch covers the UN for The Washington Post. He's a blogger for Foreign Policy magazine. Good to have you back on our program.
Good to be here, Warren. Thank you.
What explanation is being given for this?
The Saudis haven't, given much of an explanation here. In their foreign ministry statement, they said that they talked about problems with double standards, that, the Security Council is not living up to its obligation in the UN Charter to, fairly address issues of peace and security, criticize the lack of action on Syria, lack of action over the years on the Palestinian issue. So a lot of, issues that have been longstanding, and so it's not quite clear why, up until today, Saudi Arabia has been pushing for this vote, and then all of a sudden they did this complete volte-face. The expectation is that this was a decision made at the top, probably by the king, and that the diplomats in New York weren't aware of it. Certainly other diplomats I've talked to had no idea. No one seemed to see it coming.
One would think the Security Council being the most powerful body in the UN, that's the reason, or the reasons that Saudi Arabia gives are the very reasons it would want to be on the Security Council.
You would think, and also, I can understand a country like Iran, which has been under pressure from the Security Council and long argued that the council lacks legitimacy, that it's undemocratic. But in a lot of ways, the Security Council has sort of served, if not served, at least coincided with Saudi interests. A few years back, it was the Security Council that passed a resolution requiring Syria to withdraw from Lebanon, and that was an issue that that Saudi Arabia, sort of enthusiastically supported. The Council's imposed sanctions, a whole battery of sanctions on the Iranians, who are the Saudis' chief regional rival, related to the nuclear program. So, the Security Council has done a lot of things that further and advance Saudi interests. So in that sense, it seems kind of striking that they would take a decision like this. I mean, clearly they have been frustrated. Everybody's been frustrated by the lack of action in the council on Syria. But this seemed a little weird.
Has this ever happened before?
A country that, a non-permanent member has never, not taken up their seat after they were elected. There was a case in 1950 where the Soviet Union out of frustration over the council's or the UN's failure to give membership to Red China, had boycotted the Security Council for several months. However, it was during that period that the U.S. kind of rallied support for a resolution authorizing military intervention in Korea. And so I think the Soviets realized that they should never do that again because it backfired. I don't know much about this case, but apparently the Ukrainians as well back in 1948 boycotted a series of meetings, but nothing else since then.
We're talking with Colm Lynch, UN reporter for The Washington Post, blogger at Foreign Policy Magazine. This is To the Point from PRI. You said that the diplomats in New York didn't know about this, that it apparently came from Saudi Arabia, perhaps even from the king himself. Is that unprecedented? Does Saudi Arabia run its diplomacy out of the country rather than at the UN itself?
Well, I mean, I guess you could say that Obama runs diplomacy at the UN in the sense that his envoy has to carry out his orders, and there are plenty of occasions in sort of U.S. history where the White House has overruled its diplomats and changed course in the Security Council. So that's not so extraordinary. I mean, one of the questions, you know, in the back of everyone's head is there somehow a signal that's being sent to the United States? And the reason they're asking that question is that this takes place at a period in which the Saudis are quite alarmed at the course of American diplomacy in the region on a number of fronts. They've been very divided on the approach to Egypt, with the Saudis backing, warmly embracing the military government, the U.S. being much cooler. The Saudis were very much in favor of U.S. military action against Syria, not so crazy about the diplomatic agreement over the question of dismantling Syria's chemical weapons. They see it as a way that will extend President Assad's survival. Some anxiety over the rapprochement over the Iranian nuclear program. So there are a lot of areas where the Saudis feel like they're concerns are not being met by the Americans, and you know, nobody has said this. The Americans haven't said it. The Saudis haven't said it. But it's worth asking the question of whether these elements in some way set some of the the kind of context for what happened.
We're essentially out of time, but could they reverse this, or will somebody else have to be reelected?
I don't know. My guess is that that they will reconsider and that they'll show up in the seat, but it's not clear whether there'll be a new vote or not.
Colm Lynch, Washington Post, a blogger at Foreign Policy Magazine. Thanks a lot, as always, for being on our program.
All right. Thanks, Warren, for having me. Bye-bye.
In a moment, men's sports, political influence, and sexual assault on To the Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. In Maryville, Missouri, the case of last year's alleged rape of 14-year-old Daisy Coleman will be re-examined after the Kansas City Star raised disturbing questions in an investigative report on Saturday. Here's Daisy describing how it all started.
I remember going out of my window after drinking with my friend, who was 13 at the time. We were watching scary movies and just having a fun time. And after we snuck out, we got into this car where Matt picked us up. And he drove us to his house, and we snuck into his house through his basement window. And I went to go sit on the couch, and he gave me a big glass of a clear liquid.
After that, Daisy says she can't remember anything, but she ended up at 4 a.m. in the morning lying in the freezing cold on her mother's doorstep. Peggy Lowe reports for KCUR. That's public radio in Kansas City. Peggy, good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren. Nice to hear from you again.
Tell us, if you will, well, first of all, she was lucky to be alive, I take it, because it was very cold and her mother just happened to hear something and open the front door, and there she was lying there unconscious. But who was Matt?
Oh, I'm who Daisy was referring to is Matt Barnett, who is the then 17-year-old boy who was accused of raping her. In fact, he was charged with raping her at the time. This incident happened in January of 2012.
He was charged with a felony charge, right?
A felony charge charged as an adult for raping Daisy. And then another friend of his was charged with a felony, too, because he taped this encounter on an iPhone.
And did the other boy, was he prosecuted in any way?
No. What's interesting is, and I just want to back up here for a second, Warren. Actually, this story was broke here in KCUR in July. So what happened was this incident happened in January of 2012. Charges were brought right away by County Prosecutor Robert Rice. The sheriff's office jumped right on it. And all of a sudden, abruptly, 3 minutes later, or I'm sorry, 3 months later, the county prosecutor dropped the charges, citing insufficient evidence. Everybody was shocked, including Daisy and her mother and the 13-year-old girl who was also raped that night.
And the sheriff also was surprised, was he not? Didn't he say that there should have been a case brought?
Well, it's really interesting. We interviewed Sheriff Darren White up in Maryville, Missouri. It's about 2 hours north of Kansas City. And he said to us, and I'm quoting here, I have this tape, was there a crime? Hell yes, there was a crime. Should these boys be punished? Hell yes, these boys should be punished. That said, both he and the prosecutor have said the case fell apart because of the victim and the victim's families. They blame them for getting on social media and talking too much. And they said that the family refused to cooperate with law enforcement. That right there is a sticky wicket if you want to get into it.
Okay, not a lot of time for this, but what about Matt Burnett's family?
Well, that's interesting, too. The Barnett family has a long, deep political ties in Nottoway County, Missouri. Matt Barnett's grandfather is a former legislator and state patrolman. So the gossip around town was that the case was abruptly dropped because of the Barnett's connections. Now, everybody involved in that denies that. We point blank asked the county prosecutor and the sheriff and even Rex Barnett, and everyone says that's absolutely has nothing to do with it.
Now, back to this question of whether the girl and her mother actually participated, that has to do with her claim, which I gather she is reinforced recently by releasing tapes that she made when she was talking with the district attorney. She said that they didn't cooperate because they were so angry that he dropped the felony charges to misdemeanors.
Right. The family, we've spent quite a bit of time with them, and how they recounted the story was that it got to be an increasingly hostile relationship between law enforcement and the Coleman family, and they began to be very scared. They said that the sheriff's officers were yelling at them and cursing at them. The rape advocate locally, who was supposed to be helping the Colemans, was also rather cowed, it sounds like, according to the Colemans, and told Daisy and her mom, hey, I don't know if you should testify, but I'm too scared and I'm not going to take on these guys. They're too powerful. So I suggest you take the Fifth. So initially, the Colemans did take the Fifth and said they're not going to help. The charges were dropped. Then there was still one small charge still remaining about child endangerment for leaving Daisy on that porch. And so then they did actually, they were deposed later on. So they did cooperate. It was just later on.
Should point out that we are identifying Daisy Coleman because, as we just heard, she has been speaking out about this. Teenage rape victims or alleged rape victims, generally speaking, are not identified. In this case, it's different. Well, how is the town responding to all of this, Peggy Lowe?
Well, it's very interesting. The Coleman family had just moved to Maryville a couple of years ago. And when all this happened, there was so much gossip. And, you know, all the kids took to social media and there were hashtags about, you know, Matt and Jordan are free. And so they really felt cyberbullied. They felt hassled at school. The mom, Melinda Coleman, lost her job as a veterinarian in Maryville. So ultimately, they moved away. They moved back to their old town, which is about 40 miles away. Then after that, too, questionably, their house burned down. And the Colemans think that's suspicious, but the sheriff and law enforcement authorities do too. So it was just a really, really awful situation.
Well, now apparently there has been a response in the other direction. People on behalf of Daisy Coleman have been not just speaking up, but using some tough language. Here's the mayor of Maryville, Jim Fall.
The language, the tone, the vulgarity is unbelievable.
So Peggy Lowe, he says that he's received threats.
Yes, I'm sure that he probably has. The tables have absolutely turned. When this story came back up in the Star this weekend, Gawker got a hold of it. And then Anonymous, the online, you know, internet hacktivist who was also involved in the Steubenville case, they got a hold of it and really crusaded for this case. They started a hashtag Justice for Daisy. They issued a rather ominous sounding video that said, Maryville, we're coming, get ready. And people really took up the cause. I mean, Matt Barnett's Facebook page went down in flames. The school where he goes, where he attends right now, their Facebook page has been attacked. Even a local restaurant where the boys worked, their Yelp page was attacked. So it has gotten really ugly in Maryville.
Peggy Lowe at KCUR in Kansas City. You mentioned Steubenville. Ann Friedman is with us. She's a columnist for New York Magazine. Ann Friedman, good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren.
Tell us about Steubenville.
Well, this is the case that, last year earned quite a bit of notoriety for being at the intersection of what many people call rape culture and digital culture. The storyline is actually not totally dissimilar from Maryville in that it involves a young woman who, went to a party and had a lot to drink and was basically sexually assaulted, and those photos of that attack were made public later also by Anonymous, which, of course, this is, just the real overview of that case. The word Steubenville has become sort of a shorthand by now for these sorts of cases getting out of hand a little bit on social media and also among other sets of people as a way of talking about how prior to the involvement of digital media and groups like Anonymous, these sorts of cases just kind of went away without too much attention paid or were dismissed as a he said, she said. So Steubenville, while there were many other cases prior to that, became kind of the touchstone or the most famous example.
Peggy Lowe, were there videos or pictures of other kinds in this case?
Yes, there was. One of Barnett's buddies had a short video that he taped on his iPhone. Now, that disappeared quickly after this whole incident and the boys were charged. That said, apparently that video was passed around the school.
But nobody knows where it is at this point, I take it.
That's right. And law enforcement has said because they can't find it, they dropped charges against the kid who was accused of taping it.
So, Ann Friedman, do we see a pattern here? Obviously, these cases are, as you pointed out, very similar, and Steubenville has sort of become a watchword for cases of this kind. Are these things common?
Yeah, well, I mean, I worked on a feature for Newsweek several months ago and interviewed several survivors of sexual assault who did not see their cases blow up in the way Steubenville or Maryville have, who did talk about knowing that there was footage of their attack circulating or having seen photos of other women being attacked, whether it was sort of on private networks, like people texting it or sort of showing it to each other, or whether it was sort of semi-private networks, like within a Facebook page or something, rather than blast it all over Twitter and on the news the way Steubenville was. So, the experts I talked to said that, honestly, recording these types of crimes is not necessarily new. I mean, as long as, we've had recording equipment, people have recorded these kinds of crimes. It's just that now there are distribution models for that, and those photos can be shared at the touch of a button.
You say that Anonymous, in one case, the Steubenville case, did in fact release videos itself, although apparently in defense of the victim. What do you mean by the intersection of the rape culture and the digital culture, and is this a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, you have a couple of different things going on. You have, first of all, the attackers and bystanders documenting these attacks, like I said, and then sharing. And then you have the harassment of victims, both before sometimes, but especially after they sort of come forward under their real names in the case of Maryville. And then you also have, in other cases, social media being used to name and shame attackers. There was a young woman in Louisville, Kentucky, who after her school declined to pursue a case against a man she accused of raping her took to social media and put his name out there in what she said was an effort to warn other women. So it gets really complicated really quickly. A lot of advocates are conflicted because they see the personal toll that this takes on victims. They talk about these young women feeling and being re-victimized when their stories are aired on social media, frequently without their participation or consent. But activists also appreciate the fact that, you know, in many ways, seeing photos or hearing these really painful raw facts, you know, bring out some truths about rape that have conventionally been kept kind of closed and private, and we're starting to understand just how prevalent this crime is.
Ann Friedman, again, a columnist for New York Magazine. This is To the Point from PRI. Back to Peggy Lowe at KCUR in Kansas City. What about Daisy? Is she, as I understand it, there was she's had a couple of suicide attempts.
She has. And in fact, we got a tip about this last spring. And so we started pursuing it, you know, trying to pull court documents, that kind of thing. We talked at great length to her mom before we went up there. We had several interviews set last spring and early summer to go up to Maryville and hang out with the family. And those had to be postponed because twice Daisy was hospitalized because there have been suicide attempts. And she talked to us, too, about cutting. She's, you know, cutting now to sort of relieve the pain. Is what she says.
What about the other girl, the 13-year-old?
She has come forward now, too. Her name happens to be Paige, and they're sort of former besties. And her mom talked to us anonymously, actually, when we ran our piece in July, and she said, a girl that used to be very ambitious has now lost her sparkle. You know, she had wanted to become a doctor. Now she might just stay home. They are both suffering kind of from post-traumatic stress and depression. And their moms, who are also very close friends, kind of don't know what to do about it. So it's a sad situation.
What about the reexamination of the case? The district attorney now, in part as a result of your reporting and also apparently the story that came out over the weekend in the Kansas City Star, has said there's going to be a reexamination. What does that mean? Does that mean they're reopening the case or not?
You know, we have kind of we've gone short from saying reopen the case, because basically what he did is he asked a judge to appoint a special prosecutor. So whether or not that prosecutor would say bring charges is anybody's guess. It certainly will be reexamined. And for that reason, the Coleman family is absolutely thrilled, saying at least someone's going to take a second look at this and see if something actually is criminally liable.
And are they going to participate and cooperate?
Yes, they are. Yes, they said they are.
You mentioned the family. There's a brother as well, and he too was harassed and intimidated by this, wasn't he?
Right. Daisy actually has three brothers.
Three
but her
brothers.
Oldest brother.
Okay.
Yeah, and her oldest brother Charlie was friends with Matt Barnett, and Charlie even had warned Daisy about Matt Barnett, saying he kind of had this way of doing this. And so when we first met with the Colemans, we were sitting at their kitchen table drinking coffee, and Charlie was still angry. This was July, you know, a year and a half later. And he feels very protective of his little sister. They lost their father a few years ago. And so he's very angry about it. He got served subpoenas at school. It embarrassed him, you know. It ruined a lot of his friendships. So it really was rather devastating in this family and in this small town.
And he's a wrestler who got booed at a match.
That's right.
Peggy Lowe, again, as a reporter for KCUR based in Kansas City. Thanks a lot, Peggy, for being on our program. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We're going to continue this conversation with Ann Friedman, a columnist for New York Magazine, and others as well. Later on, our talking point, a terrorist bomb and an effort to understand. We'll hear all about that. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Orin Olney back with To The Point. We're talking today about the alleged rape of a 14-year-old girl by a high school football star whose family had political connections and who was not been prosecuted, although the case once again is being re-examined. It's all too familiar to the Steubenville, Ohio case, which has become sort of a watchword for cases of this kind. Ann Friedman, columnist for New York Magazine, is still with us. We have another Friedman, Jacqueline Friedman, who is editor of Yes Means Yes, Visions of Female Sexual Power and World Without Rape. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
How common is this?
Much more common than we would like to think. You know, I think that one of the dangers of talking about is this another Steubenville is the idea that when we don't hear about them, there isn't another Steubenville. You know, in fact, the Maryville assault happened before the Steubenville assault, and many, many more like this, somewhat uncountable numbers have happened since then. It's just the ones that the media happens to pick up on for whatever set of reasons that we hear about. We know that somewhere between 1 in 5 and 1 in 8 women will be raped in her lifetime in the U.S., and some of those women will be raped multiple times. It's alarmingly common. If women were being carjacked or kidnapped or any other felony violent crime at that rate, we would be having a national conversation about the violence epidemic.
1 in 5 or 1 in 8 American women are going to be raped?
Yes, that's the best research that we have.
Where do you get that research? Do you look at police records, or do you talk to people who are knowledgeable about individual incidents? That's an extraordinary figure.
It's more based on social science research, polling, individual interviews, but some of it is from, you know, the Department of Justice. This is not from, you know, Ms. Magazine research. This is just from very mainstream research sources.
So how do you account for it, or how do those who do the research account for it?
How do you account for it? Well, there are no consequences. I mean, you see even in this case where there was video of the actual assault that these boys believed and were correct in believing that they could get away with it. And so they do. You know, we know that most rapes are perpetrated by a very small number of guys who do it again and again. And I should say here, I'm talking about the sexual assault of older teen and adult women. Child sexual abuse is a somewhat different thing, and the numbers are not inclusive of that. So, you know, we know that these guys, they know what they're doing. They may not use the word, the R word, to describe it to themselves, but they know they don't have consent. These kids obviously knew that they did something that they would get in trouble for. They wouldn't have taken such care not to wake up her brothers, right? They knew it wasn't okay what they did. They did it because they thought they could get away with it, and because we have a very deeply twisted idea in our culture about masculinity. You know, one of those things that all these cases which involve video tell us is that this is a social performance, right? This is not about male sexual pleasure in any way, right? This is about showing your buddies what you can do and that you're a real man. And we have a very toxic idea about masculinity in this culture, which involves power over women instead of power with women. And until we shift that, and, you know, you mentioned at the beginning of the segment, you know, that this has everything to do with male sports culture in the U.S., which is a place we see a lot of this toxic masculinity get played out, with women as trophies, women as reward. You saw that with the expose of college football and how those programs operate last month. It's all tied together.
Let me introduce Ed Heisler, who is Executive Director of Men as Peacemakers. Mr. Heisler, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Do you work with sports groups and others to try to rectify this situation? And if so, what do you do?
Yes, we work to connect men with women directly in addressing both sexual and domestic violence prevention. One of our programs focuses specifically on working with athletic programs to embed sexual and domestic violence prevention into the very fabric of their organization.
Tell us a bit more about what we're hearing about who the repeat offenders are. Are these people that are otherwise regarded as nice guys?
Yeah, in fact, there's a profile that comes from Stephen Thompson called the Nice Guy Rapist Profile that kind of outlines how those sexual assaults oftentimes are perpetrated. I would say that when we're talking about athletic culture, it's very similar to the rest of the broader culture, that these are guys that fit right into the rest of our society. And unfortunately, they are in a social environment, broadly speaking, that promotes the exploitation and the domination of women. And when they're part of an athletic culture, they also tend to have kind of a bubble around them because of their status and their entitlement, so that can provide some protection.
What about college fraternities?
College fraternities would be a similar sort of story, right? And in a lot of ways, sometimes those organizations will really bring forward and highlight the sort of negative ideas of masculinity that we would like not to support, and there can be protection through those groups as well. But for both college athletics and for fraternities, the other thing that is true is that there are groups that bring with them a great deal of influence, and so they can be some of the most effective leaders that you have in campus and community environments as well.
So there's good and bad, obviously, in these cultures. Is the association of sports and fraternities and this idea of masculinity and the demonstration of power that we heard about earlier a relatively recent development, and does it have anything to do, do you think, with the culture itself, and particularly the development of the digital culture?
I think it's a story that in some ways is as old as at least colonization, and then goes back in lots of cultures for a long, long, long period of time. But the digital culture has really normalized a lot of the exploitative, dominating, and violent sort of norms that exist towards women in this society. So we often, when the Steubenville case broke, we would take a look at that, some of those videos that came out, and ask a question about, if you consider that young man before he committed that sexual assault, and think about him waking up in bed to his favorite song. What's his favorite song? Telling him about men, women, sex, relationships. He opens his eyes. What do the posters in his room tell him about where the value of men and women come from? Is it from women's bodies and from the pleasure that they bring to men? He gets up. He pulls his pants on. The jeans have been marketed by teams of adults who have designed marketing strategies to hit on gender norms and relationships and sex in a certain way. And so we start to see young people and the rest of us in the society surrounded by what we call a sexually toxic society.
So, Ann Friedman, back to you, columnist for New York Magazine. Are we sort of perpetuating what we used to think of as a kind of caveman culture?
When we share and talk about these things on social media, I mean, I think that, look, it's already sort of happening. It's already a conversation that is rampant among young people, and you know, as has been pointed out thoroughly, this is not necessarily a conversation that we think is helpful. I mean, it really is perpetuating a lot of things that we wouldn't necessarily sit our own children down and tell them about gender relations. So I think that when we talk about it, you know, it's important to talk in the same spaces that young people are having these conversations. You know, the answer is not like let's plug our ears and close our eyes and hope that these conversations stop in these spaces. I think that being actively involved and modeling the sorts of conversations we want to have around sexuality and gender roles is totally crucial.
Back to Jacqueline Friedman, editor of Yes Means Yes, Visions of Female Sexual Power and World Without Rape. Are there ways of having healthy conversations about this? Does it require something more than just warning your daughter not to drink?
Oh, gosh, absolutely. First of all, it involves warning your son not to drink and to get affirmative consent from his sex partners. When we focus on girls being responsible for preventing their own rapes, we are participating in the problem, which is, you know, a culture that wants to blame the victim and let the perpetrators off the hook at all costs. So we really need to be careful about that. There's nothing wrong with talking to your daughter and saying, hey, there are risks out there. We wish it weren't true, but here they are. But leaving it there puts all the onus on her, and you have to think, if she had disobeyed, like, you know, like Daisy did. You know, she's a 14-year-old girl. She snuck out of the house. She evidently had a relationship with her parents such that they could talk about that, and they supported her. But if you grow up thinking, oh, if I break the rules, you know, my parents are going to be mad at me, oftentimes that actually has the opposite effect. Instead, what we need to do is talk to young people about affirmative consent, right? We need to move the model of sexuality away from, like, guys are going to try to get sex and you need to keep it from them, to a model where we say, you know, sexuality can be a good and powerful thing in some circumstances. And everybody, regardless of gender, is responsible for making sure that their partner is actually into whatever is happening. And when we shift that model, we stop seeing sex as sort of a commodity and women as the passive object in it, we start seeing what is sexual assault. You know, one of the most heartbreaking things to come out of the Steubenville court case was they had one of the witnesses, he was a boy who saw the assault, he didn't perpetrate it, and they asked him why he didn't intervene. And he said, because I didn't know that's what rape looks like, because he saw a passed out woman and a guy doing something to her, right? If we expect that everyone, even if it's a woman, is only going to be having sex if they're actually interested and excited about it, that everyone should look like an active participant, when we shift that, we can really start to intervene in productive ways.
Ed Heisler, back to you. With the men as peacemakers, there are universities and colleges that have abolished fraternities in part because this kind of thing goes on. Is that the best solution?
You know, I think that one thing that was pointed out is that sometimes there's no consequences for, in fact, oftentimes in the case of sexual assault, there's no consequences. It's very hard on college campuses and in communities to see these crimes effectively kind of prosecuted and people held accountable. So I would say that for fraternities to see some consequences when things like this happen would be good. But as a whole, I think that campuses, I think that fraternities as organizations, and I think that communities need to take responsibility for shaping environments that promote the gender equity, that promote the shared consent, that promote equity between men and women. And that's a really important piece of this equation. Oftentimes we say the problem's just too big and there's nothing that we can do about it, but the solutions don't need to be as big as the problems. And there are some very simple things that we can do within those environments to help chip away at the environment that supports so much sexual assault.
What are they? How do you, for example, teach intervention to young men who might see something of this kind going on? What do you say to them?
Well, there's a lot of different programs out there that help young men and young women learn how to kind of speak up when they see something dangerous happen. The other thing that I would say is with athletics, for instance, we have programming that connects college athletes with youth and after-school programs. They facilitate athletic activities. You can imagine how the status of athletes excites those young people. And then we train them to facilitate circle conversations in a restorative sort of process that deal with gender equity and respect and how you build friendships and relationships with one another. And that puts those youth in an environment that is going to help them understand this idea that that the well-being and the joy of women and men together is important both in sexual relationships and in our broader relationships. That would be one example.
Jacqueline Friedman, back to you. It seems to me that the parental involvement is obviously very important, and the relationship that parents have with their children, because a lot of girls, as I understand it, have these incidents occur to them and then are afraid to report, as you indicated. Do you need to talk as much to the parents as you do to the girls?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And, you know, the parents grew up in this culture, too, and are just as likely to have these toxic and challenging and damaging beliefs about masculinity and sexuality and sexual violence. So I think starting with parents or talking to parents at the same time as we're talking to young people is very important. And I would say that the best thing a parent can do if they're concerned about the safety of their child, whether it's their safety from sexual violence or their safety from being a perpetrator, we have to remember to talk to our young people about not perpetrating, is to sort of do the work themselves, right? Think about what are your own attitudes as a parent about sexuality and about sexual violence and about masculinity, and to start there and to be transparent, you know, with your kids that you know, it's a complicated and sometimes dangerous and messed up world that we live in, but we can make change. We can live in a healthier way. We don't have to do it the way it's always been done.
Ann Friedman, back to you with New York Magazine. What about the media and the advertising business and the general objectification of women that we see in so many places? Is there anything that can be done about that? Sex sells.
That's true, but you know, for those of us who are you know, reporters and cultural critics, I think that, you know, maintaining a critical eye toward that culture and not sort of throwing up our hands and being accepting that this is just sort of how it is incredibly important. I think that we can also highlight alternatives. I mean, the very fact that you know, we're also talking about, like, hey, you know, you might want to have a conversation with your son about these issues in the same way you would warn your daughter, is a real good that we can all provide, rather than sort of amplifying existing narratives about women and gender.
Okay, so are you, Jacqueline Friedman, optimistic or not?
I am optimistic. I think the conversation is coming closer to the surface than it has been in years past. You know, I've been doing anti-sexual violence activism for 20 years now, and I feel like as much as these stories that we hear in the national media are the exception and that the rule is most of these stories don't get covered, we are hearing them more, and we are hearing more productive conversation. So I think it's slow, right? But I'm optimistic about change.
Okay, we're going to leave it at that. Thank you all very much for being with us. Jacqueline Friedman, Yes Means Yes, Visions of Female Sexual Power and World Without Rape. Ed Heisler, Executive Director of Men as Peacemakers. Ann Friedman, columnist for New York Magazine. And our earlier guest, Peggy Lowe, reporter at KCUR in Kansas City, who broke this story originally, the one we began talking about in July of last year. Great to have you all. This is To the Point from PRI. When they lived in Jerusalem, David Harris Gershon's wife, Jamie, was nearly killed by a Palestinian bomber. Others died. When the bomber was tried, neither Jamie nor David wanted to go to the courtroom. But after they moved back to the United States and had two children, David was still haunted by the event. The result is a book called What Do You Buy the Children of the Terrorist Who Tried to Kill Your Wife? We'll talk with him in a moment on To the Point.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Mormon Olney back with today's talking point. What Do You Buy the Children of the Terrorist Who Tried to Kill Your Wife? Has been described, in fact, it's on the book jacket, as an act of forgiveness. David Harris Gershon, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Do you think of it as an act of forgiveness?
No, I actually think of it more as an act of reconciliation as opposed to forgiveness. I mean, this was an effort which was both personal in terms of healing and political on my part in terms of trying to understand better Palestinians, particularly those who were involved in the attack, as opposed to an actual act of forgiveness.
Okay, we're getting ahead of ourselves, as the title does. Let us go back and tell our listeners first about the incident itself, then about the first reaction that you and your wife both had.
Sure. My wife and I were both graduate students at Hebrew University. This was 2002, and I was at home. My wife was at the university at the time at a cafeteria, and I got a call from somebody who said that there had been an electrical explosion. I thought that was strange that somebody would call me, and I turned on the television and saw the words in Hebrew, piguo, which means terrorist attack, and I immediately got another call from a person who I did not know, who basically said that my wife was injured and she needed me at the hospital. It turns out that a Palestinian bomber, his name is Mohammed Odeh, had placed a backpack full of explosives right on the table next to her and remotely detonated it. She survived, amazingly, by simply bending beneath the table before the bomb went off, not knowing that there was a bomb next to her. And the two friends with whom she was sitting was killed at the time. And when I heard this news that she had been injured, I raced to the hospital. I convinced a taxi driver to take me to the hospital. He had refused because everything was blocked off, and I convinced him that he would take me there. And somehow I eventually was able to push my way through the emergency room doors. There were families lined up, people trying to find family members who had been either injured or killed, and was brought before a woman who I didn't recognize. And suddenly she opened her mouth and said hello, and at that point I knew that it was my wife, that Jamie was there before me.
She was horribly injured, and it took her a long time to recover. There was concern that she wouldn't be able to have children. She ultimately did, however, and you now have two children. At what point did it occur to you that you ought to try to understand Mohammed Odeh, the man who, in fact, ignited the bomb?
Well, this was many years later. We returned to the States, and my wife was able to, through process of therapy, recover from this psychically as much as one could expect to from an experience like this. I, on the other hand, I really never gave myself license to view myself as a victim, and I ignored it. I pushed everything emotionally away, and suddenly in the States, as a new father and a high school teacher, I began to become paralyzed by PTSD-like symptoms. I was hyperventilating in the classroom, and I couldn't sleep at night, and I tried therapy, and it didn't work, and I tried compartmentalizing, it didn't work, and that led me to, really in an act of desperation, just try and confront the attack as a way to understand it. And when I began researching, I read in an AP article that Mohammed Odeh, when he was captured by Israeli authorities, had expressed remorse, had said the words, "I'm sorry." And when I saw those words, "I'm sorry," something within me intuitively knew that perhaps my path towards personal recovery led back to Israel and also to understanding Palestinians, of people who I really, at that point, admittedly knew nothing about.
You, in fact, thought of them as less than human, did you not?
I'm embarrassed to admit that, and I don't think this is atypical, unfortunately, for American Jews. I really thought of them as caricatures of evil. I mean, this is what I was kind of brought up to believe, and I think American mainstream media perpetuates this view. And so I really honestly did not think of them as human in terms of being actual real people. They were simply my enemy, and this is all that I knew about them. And perhaps one of the ironies of this is that, my encounter with this extremist element that is undeniably woven in the far reaches of Palestinian society, this terrorist attack, led me to research Palestinian culture and history and understand more fully the broader Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and also brought me to want to meet Mohammed Odeh and meet his family.
Do you think he wanted to meet you?
Well, it continues to be an open question. Through a long process, human rights activists who helped me, I actually made contact with the family, and they invited me. And in our conversations, they told me that, yes, he did want to meet with me, and that he had told prison officials that he did had green-lighted such a meeting. And Israeli prison authorities told me otherwise. And so I've throughout this entire process, had two differing stories on whether or not this really was his desire.
Back to the title of your book, when you went to meet the family, what did you buy the children of the terrorist who tried to kill your wife?
Well, the title is derived from kind of an absurd scene. The Odeh family invited me to their home. A letter that I had written to them was delivered where I expressed what I wanted, which was just to understand them, that it was I was coming in peace and not revenge. And the evening before I went, I just felt like I needed something to immediately show them that my intentions indeed were good. And I thought, why not presents for the children? So I found myself in a Toys R Us in Jerusalem looking at, pop culture items meant for American children. And, I picked out a stencil set for a young girl and a Rubik's Cube for a young boy, and brought them and gave them to the children when I arrived.
Were they glad to get them?
They were. And I chronicle this in the book. The moment when they kind of approached me, my first thought was that they were just beautiful children. They were normal children, and they were grateful. They didn't know exactly who I was, but it was a very warm environment. I was treated like an honored guest, and it was what, before I went, was really a very fearful meeting. I was afraid of them, and I think they were afraid of me. I was immediately set at ease by the children and by the family.
How did your wife, Jamie, feel about this?
Well, she was supportive. I mean, I think this prospect scared her, but she also understood. She could see how much I personally was suffering. The reverberations of the attack were still affecting me, and so she supported me in this. She allowed me to do this and set me forward, even though this was not her process. She had already gone through her own personal recovery and really did not want to go through anything like this on her end.
What did you find out about the Israeli government as you were researching this, and very particularly the efforts that were going on to achieve a ceasefire between Palestinians and Israelis at about the time that the bomb went off?
Well, one of the sections in the book chronicles the immediate political context within which the 2002 Hebrew University bombing took place. And at that time, there was really what most observers considered to be a historic ceasefire opportunity between Hamas and really all of the extremist organizations and Fatah and the Palestinian Authority. There was a really unprecedented ceasefire draft, which was going to disavow civilian violence and terrorist attacks as a strategic method towards trying to, relieve themselves of the occupation and gain independence. And right after this particular document was signed, and I go through this really detailed in the book, Israel decided to strike suspected terrorist leader in Gaza. And it was that moment in which the ceasefire raveled. And, you know, one might argue that this attack that took place in 2002 was kind of a direct result of those unraveling ceasefire agreements.
How has your book been received in Israel?
In Israel, it's been mixed. I mean, I've had limited reactions from Israel because the book has only been published in English in the UK and US. But a review was just published in Israel, and I've had mixed reviews. Some people have basically congratulated me on the type of reconciliation process on a personal level that many people think need to happen on a much broader level for this to happen nationally. There are others, both in America and in Israel, who basically look at me as a traitor. I mean, some have painted me as an anti-Semite and a self-hating Jew for having written this and having had the audacity to actually meet with and humanize Palestinians. And, you know, those are unfortunate views and views meant to delegitimize the book and my message, but, you know, views that exist.
David Harris Gershon, thank you so much for being on our program. The book, again, is What Do You Buy the Children of the Terrorist Who Tried to Kill Your Wife? An effort, as he describes it, of reconciliation and understanding. It's great to have you on your program. It's a wonderful book. Thanks a lot for being on our show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
To the Point, produced this week by Christian Bordahl, Carrie Cavanaugh, Katie Cooper, Evan George, Anna Scott, and Caitlin Schamberg. Our technical director is Mike Newport. Our managing producer is Sonia Geis. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.